This show is a Hopful Media podcast production. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. The new year doesn't require a new you, maybe just a less burdened you. Therapy can help more easily identify what weighs you down and holds you back by offering an unbiased perspective to better understand your relationships, motivations, and emotions. This past year was full of a lot of ups and downs and uncertainties for me, and those are by no means done. But being able to talk about it and get some outside perspective on what I'm experiencing is incredibly helpful and makes everything at least more comfortable, if not okay. With BetterHelp, they do the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals instead of searching for a therapist online. A short questionnaire helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment means they typically get it right the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 160, Medicine and Philosophy. Just to get things started today, a reminder that I will be participating in this year's Intelligent Speech Online as a keynote speaker. I will be joining Matt Mitrovich and Rob and Jamie from Totalis Rankium as the keynotes, alongside a whole list of other speakers and presenters in roundtables and feature presentations throughout the day. Intelligent Speech will be on February 28th, 2026, starting at 9 a.m. U.S. Eastern or 2 p.m. British time. Tickets are available now for $30 at intelligentspeechonline.com, and you can use my promo code PERSIA to get an additional 10% off that full ticket price. Again, I will be presenting on the companionship and rivalry of the Persian kings and their nobility at Intelligent Speech on February 28th, 9 a.m. U.S. Eastern Time. Get your tickets at intelligentspeechonline.com. All right, moving on to the episode. There was a bit more of a delay from last time than I had wanted. I started 2026 just kind of miserably sick and losing my voice for 2 weeks. So if you can hear that in this episode, that's what's going on. Today is the first time I have felt like I had enough of a speaking voice to record in a while. In that last episode, I provided a highly abbreviated summary of Greek philosophy from its beginnings in the 6th century BCE down to the Hellenistic period. We wrapped up on the Epicureans, both because I got tired of talking about philosophers I dislike, and because the Epicurean school provides the best segue into this episode. An unfortunate fact of historiography is that while metaphysical philosophy continued flourishing in Greece, and the Ptolemaic court at Alexandria patronized many of the mathematicians and early scientists that the Greeks called physicists, very little has survived of the academic pursuits happening under the Seleucids. This is not because the Seleucid kings didn't patronize academic pursuits, at least not entirely. There is something to be said for the fact that the early Seleucids did not put as much effort into gathering philosophers at their courts as their contemporaries in Egypt or Pella, which allowed Alexandria and Macedon to develop as secondary philosophical poles in addition to Athens, which traditionally dominated that field. That said, up to our current point in the narrative, we just don't have much evidence for the philosophical pursuits of the Seleucid court. It's really only after our current point in the narrative, with the late 3rd and early 2nd centuries BCE, that a number of notable Seleucid-affiliated philosophers began to emerge. And one commonality appears for most of them. They were Epicureans, at least until one of those Epicureans was executed, but that's a tale for a later episode. This would at least partially explain why we do not see as much Seleucid influence on Hellenistic philosophy as other contemporary states. Even though the Epicurean school remained one of the most prominent philosophical traditions in the Mediterranean, it only occasionally captured the same level of attention as the Stoics or Platonism. And ultimately, it was one of the schools most neglected by Christian and Muslim scribes who worked to preserve other philosophies over the centuries. In fact, part of the reason for the decline seems to lie in a pattern observed by both ancient and early modern writers when describing the Epicureans. While people adopted Epicureanism during its height, Epicureans almost never rejected their own philosophy. This meant that the lingering beliefs of converts never really had a chance to influence the other schools and religious movements later in history. That made it less relevant when a scribe had to decide what they would copy down for the next generation. Certainly, many philosophers of other schools originated in the Seleucid Empire. You'll find no shortage of Hellenistic thinkers with epithets relating them to cities in the east, especially the traditionally Greek cities of Anatolia. One of the principals of the Stoic school in Athens was even a Diogenes of Babylon, who was born right around our current point in the historical narrative. However, those philosophers are generally known for their work conducted after they moved to the West. This stands as somewhat ironic when one of those Epicurean philosophers, Diogenes of Seleucia, who lived at the Seleucid court as a friend of the king, is introduced by the author Athenaeus with a note that the king in question actually preferred Stoicism. It's entirely plausible to think that some of the philosophers in other schools that became known for their work elsewhere started in the East, but we do not have records of that early work. Athenaeus' story of Diogenes Seleucus is potentially apocryphal, and bears some resemblance to other stories we have discussed in the past, like the tale of the Achaemenid prince Mecistes. Supposedly, Diogenes asked the king for a purple robe and a crown so he could act as a priest of virtue, but then he gave the outfit to a singer he had fallen for, and the king invited this girl to court, wearing the priestly ensemble to the amusement of the courtiers and the embarrassment of the philosopher. I should note that when ancient sources describe an attractive young woman as a singer, there's about a 50-50 chance that it is a euphemism for prostitute. mildly amusing anecdotes aside, I do want to explore Diogenes Seleucus as the priest of virtue a bit more, because it does connect to some concepts in Epicurean philosophy. Virtue is the conventional translation for the Greek philosophical concept of arete. It's a good enough translation for the philosophical sense in modern English, I suppose, especially because that is the word's primary meaning in modern Greek. However, a better option is probably just goodness, because arete encompassed all manner of generally positive concepts in ancient Greece. Regardless, we can probably assume that this Diogenes meant the Epicurean sense of virtue, which meant actions that would achieve ataraxia, peace of mind, through the pursuit of pleasure. As I said last time, the Epicureans were hedonistic, but on a lifelong scale rather than seeking immediate gratification. They actually promoted abstinence, frugality, and sobriety on the basis that it would lead to greater pleasure overall, despite comparatively minor pain in the moment of temptation. But that is the concept that Diogenes was presenting himself as the priest of, as if the abstract concept of Epicurean arete was a god itself. That pairs nicely with the almost deist approach many Epicureans took to religion. In their conception of the world, the gods were all but irrelevant. Whether they existed or not, the gods did not take any actions to affect human life beyond the general existence of concepts represented by the divine. As such, all of the traditional priestly activities that polytheistic religions employed were useless, and the only concepts that actually affected life were achieving arete through the pursuit of Epicurean pleasure. And that is the point Diogenes tried to make to the Seleucid court by presenting himself in the costume of a more traditional priest. Zeno of Sidon got his start under Seleucid auspices in Phoenicia before ultimately relocating to Athens, where he taught another Syrian expatriate, Philodemus of Gadara. Zeno's work is almost exclusively preserved through Philodemus's own citations, as well as those of the Roman orator Cicero and the biographer Diogenes Laertius. Man after my own heart, Zeno famously called Socrates the Attic buffoon, and routinely criticized the more traditionally Socratic schools of thought. Most notably, Zeno added an additional layer to the Epicurean pursuit of pleasure, saying that ataraxia was not achieved solely through enjoying that pleasure, but also by setting reasonable expectations for how much pleasure you could attain, and how much you would actually enjoy it. Again, man after my own heart, Zeno argued against Euclidean geometry on the basis that logical deductions based on the fundamental principles of mathematics were not enough to constitute proof of those deductions on their own. Which is technically true. For something to be proven, you still have to demonstrate how the math works. Not just that it would be logically true, but at a certain point in complex mathematics, that is splitting hairs. Zeno, in turn, was heavily criticized by Posidonius of Apamea, a Stoic philosopher who played an important role in transitioning the center of Stoic education from Athens to Rhodes in the late 2nd century BC. Posidonius was highly critical of not just Epicureanism, but in his own histories, he was critical of the debaucherous behavior of Seleucid monarchs in particular. Given the apparent connection between the Seleucid court and many Epicurean philosophers, it's hard not to imagine that Posidonius was critical of that relationship. Initially, when I planned this episode, this is where I would have transitioned to talking about the influence of native West Asian religious practices on Hellenistic philosophy. But I can barely find any literature on the subject. There is lots to be said about the influence of Iranian, Mesopotamian, and Egyptian beliefs on Hellenistic religion, which will be a topic another day, but the vast majority of modern scholarship focuses on Eastern influences to early Greek philosophy, especially the pre-Socratics and Plato himself. Some of this is almost definitely the result of scholastic bias. That is, the period of Greek philosophy and West Asian scholarship that gets the most attention, and therefore those are the topics that get published. However, there also seems to be an element of philosophical schools becoming entrenched with their own variations of concepts that developed out of Achaemenid-era influences on the earlier philosophical schools. By the Hellenistic period, the philosophical schools were used to arguing their points against one another and would easily have approached West Asian beliefs in the same way, viewing them as another philosophical belief set to be argued against, rather than completely unfamiliar ideas to be incorporated. The exception comes in the form of Greek contact with Buddhism, especially after the secession of Bactria under Diodotus sparked more communication between the Greek settlers of modern Afghanistan and their Indian neighbors. However, the paucity of sources from the Greco-Bactrian kingdom leaves any discussion of this extremely tenuous. It's hard to imagine that additional contact with India, such as Asoka Maurya sending emissaries all the way to Libya, had no impact on Greek thought, but identifying any specifics remains all but impossible. For every potential Indic influence on Hellenism, a more readily available Western antecedent is also available, and skeptics remain strong in their position. The easy example here is the idea of reincarnation. It's often suggested that concepts of reincarnation entered Hellenistic-era Greek beliefs through contact with India, but we can also see reincarnation being bandied about as a concept as early as someone like Pythagoras in the 6th century BC, 300 years before any prolonged Greek contact with the Far East. Even with many noteworthy philosophers, especially Epicureans, in and around the Seleucid inner circle, Antioch never became a center of philosophical education, and the most notable philosophers from the Seleucid court often moved on to Athens, Rhodes, or eventually Rome. This is a significant reflection of Seleucid priorities for most of their history. While the Seleucids were always involved in Mediterranean politics, they could never afford to be as invested in Greece as the other Hellenistic powers. While the Antigonids were physically present in the peninsula to vie for power, and Ptolemaic naval force allowed the kings of Egypt to maintain a presence in the Greek islands and interfere directly against the Antigonids, the Seleucids had a vast land empire to maintain. As such, their investments in the arts and intellectualism often reflected their subjects. They sponsored local temples and Seleucid building projects included Zoroastrian fire shrines and temples, probably contributing in significant part to Iranian worship transitioning from a primarily outdoor affair to one based in constructed sanctuaries. Likewise, the Seleucids invested time and resources into the maintenance of the local intelligentsia. This would have been a conscious continuation of Achaemenid policies toward the same groups, albeit with a more Hellenized sensibility focused on physical construction. That said, one traditionally Greek intellectual pursuit that the Seleucids and Achaemenids alike were focused on was medicine. The Achaemenid period saw the Eastern Mediterranean shift from considering Egypt the greatest producer of medical knowledge to Greece, and many Greek physicians found a home in the courts of Persian kings and their satraps. This continued under the Seleucids, and Seleucid territory really did produce some of the most noteworthy medical physicians of their day. Unfortunately, very little has survived directly from any of these Seleucid physicians and their medical treatises. This is not particularly unique to the Seleucid side of medical science. Aside from the earlier so-called father of medicine, Hippocrates, very few ancient Greek physicians' works have survived in any meaningful capacity. Many of them were summarized by the Roman writer Aulus Cornelius Celsus in the 1st century with his book De Medicina, and they were largely supplanted in medical study for centuries after the career of Aelius Galenus, better known simply as Galen, a Roman-era medical dynamo. His work became the basis for medicine across Europe and West Asia for centuries and remained influential until the 19th century. So we are actually going to spend the rest of this episode on Greek medicine, which begins, for all intents and purposes, with Hippocrates. Knowing multiple languages can open new doors, whether that's making travel easier, creating new career opportunities, or just a desire to learn. Language learning is its own gate of all nations. Rosetta Stone makes it easier and more immersive than ever. They provide the leading language learning program for desktop and mobile to fully immerse you in your chosen language with a more natural and effective learning experience. I've mentioned this before, but the True Accent speech recognition tool is a very cool feature if you've gotten a little too used to the surprisingly limited set of sounds we use in English. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience and millions of users for the 25 languages they offer, including Spanish, French, Arabic, Persian, and many others. Their intuitive learning process helps you think and speak with confidence, and it's designed for long-term retention. With both a desktop option and a mobile app, you can take language learning on the go and practice whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Plus, it's an incredible value with a lifetime membership to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. According to his earliest biographer, Hippocrates came from a long line of physicians on the island of Kos, dedicated to the local Asclepion, a temple to the medicine god Asclepios. Asclepia, like this, across the Mediterranean, doubled as ancient Greek hospitals and medical schools. Hippocrates is sometimes credited as being the first Greek physician to recognize that disease was caused by environmental factors rather than supernatural forces. This is almost certainly an exaggeration, but he was one of the first physicians to advocate and proselytize in favor of preventative treatment. He also benefited from the rise of philosophy as a way of thinking outside the bounds of traditional Greek temples, and adopted some of the Pythagoreans' reasoning and methods in his own medical research. The two main medical schools of the time, on Kos and the nearby island of Knidos, had different approaches. The Knidos Asclepion focused on diagnosing and treating individual symptoms, but often struggled when multiple symptoms were comorbid. Hippocrates' fellows on Kos focused on prognosis, collecting information from multiple cases and making predictions, and passive treatment that prevented further harm. Both schools lacked a fundamental knowledge of human anatomy, as even in the Asclepia, dissection of human remains was extremely taboo. Modern medical practice generally aligns with the idea of the Knidos school, but without essential anatomical knowledge to best prescribe treatment, the Kos school often appeared to have better results. The lack of anatomical studies was not aided by the widespread belief in humorism in antiquity. And by antiquity, I mean until about 150 years ago, when germ theory became more commonly accepted. The exact details of the humors varied across time and space, but in the ancient Greek context, it roughly came down to four fluids within the human body: blood, yellow bile, black bile, and phlegm. Blood was, well, blood, the red stuff in your veins. It was associated with enthusiasm, activity, and vitality, and it was believed to originate in the heart. Not entirely accurate, but close enough. Yellow bile was associated with ambition, aggression, and decisiveness, and thought to originate in the gallbladder, which I guess does contain bile, so they weren't entirely off. But it is not the primary producer of the color yellow in the human body. This is where the humors get weird, though. Despite the specific organ identified as a starting point, yellow bile was identified as any yellow or brownish fluid in or coming from the body, to include vomit, feces, and urine. Black bile, Greek Malina kole, became the root word for melancholy, because it was associated with sadness and depression. It was thought to originate in the spleen, and associated with the dark fluids that physicians sometimes found in tumors, the kidneys, or the liver. In reality, that black bile was a mixture of coagulated blood, other fluids, and often necrotic tissue. Phlegm was not phlegm in the modern medical sense. It was basically any pale or transparent bodily fluid, to include saliva, sweat, mucus, and cerebral fluid. Thanks to the latter, it was closely associated with the brain. Pre-modern medicine, and even relatively recent medicine in the West, was all about balancing these humors. Sometimes that was based on the wrong colors appearing in the wrong places, like mucus becoming increasingly yellow when sick. But sometimes, if a symptom was too closely associated with one of the four, like a fever being associated with the energetic nature of blood, the physician might prescribe a treatment to expel some of the excess humor. This is why bleeding and leeches were such common pre-modern treatments. They were trying to get rid of what they thought was excess blood. Hippocrates added to this a belief in the crisis, a point in the cycle of illness when the disease would triumph and kill the patient, or the patient would make it through and begin recovering. It was a deeply held belief in the body's ability to just naturally rebalance itself. The classic example of this is a fever breaking shortly after hitting its peak temperature. Hippocrates believed that rest and immobilization were of paramount importance to medical treatment, because engaging in other activities could throw off the delicate balance of humors. This was in opposition to any sort of complex treatment of the sort preferred by the Cnidian school, for fear that a misdiagnosis would lead to a treatment that threw the humors even further out of balance. On one hand, this led to some accidentally good ideas, like trying to make the recovery area as clean and sterile as possible, and only ever using clean water or sterile wine to clean open wounds. This was not in the Hippocratic mind because it prevented germs, but because it minimized outside influences on the humors. On the other hand, this same belief led Hippocrates to develop some truly torturous treatments, like the Hippocratic bench, a sick bed that forcibly held the patient in place. This belief in the body's natural ability to heal from almost anything also led to a reluctance to use any direct treatment like drugs, but recommending a fast on the basis that to eat is to feed your sickness. If this sounds like a truly insane way to carry out medicine, you're not wrong. But because the Kos school emphasized prognosis and prevention, they ended up being more successful than their Canadian neighbors almost solely by virtue of preventing additional damage. The emphasis on stasis in Hippocratic medicine, be it through a clean workspace or immobilization, also inadvertently did the work that germ theory would promote over 2,000 years later, and made the Hippocratics some of the best at healing wounds and broken bones because they wouldn't let their patients do any more damage to themselves if possible. And of course, Hippocrates' work spread the so-called Hippocratic Oath. Although it was probably at least inspired by similar oaths of office taken by other physicians at various Asclepia, and even the most ancient surviving versions are much younger than Hippocrates himself. The ancient version bears only a cursory resemblance to the oath taken by modern medical professionals, but a phrase from Hippocrates' treatise on epidemics remains one of the most relevant aspects of the Hippocratic Oath. Quote, "Practice two things in your dealing, either help or do no harm to the patient. Or, as modern bioethics usually puts it, first do no harm." After Hippocrates' time, two distinct schools of medical thought emerged in the 4th century BCE, called the Dogmatics and the Empiricists. The Dogmatics received their name because they professed to follow the writings of Hippocrates to an almost religious degree. They also dove deep into the philosophical side of Hippocrates' approach to medicine, arguing that physical experimentation was unnecessary when they could use logical reasoning to deduce the hidden causes of disease, and thus know how to prognosticize their patients and prepare treatment. Hopefully, everyone listening can see the flaw in this approach. They were making logical deductions about invisible influences on the human body while knowing next to nothing about anatomy, unless it was part of an absolutely essential surgery. And even then, they were ignorant to the almost microscopic parts of many bodily systems. The empiricists valued the work of Hippocrates and his predecessors, but sought to understand the evident causes for disease. They accepted that they would probably never understand the hidden causes that Hippocrates had focused on, because, as far as they could tell at the time, the nature behind those causes was incomprehensible. However, that did not mean they could not work to make more causes of disease and illness evident. These were the physicians that tried out new treatments, took detailed notes, and occasionally dissected animals or the odd illegal human cadaver to try and learn more about anatomy and illness. They wanted to know as many contributing factors leading up to an illness as possible, and would compare how different patients reacted to the same treatments. These ancient empiricists pioneered the so-called tripod method. Observe the patient during their care, document the history of treatment and illness as recounted by the patient or other physicians, and analogize the experience of one patient while treating another. One of these empiricists was also the most important physician, and by far the best documented, to spend time at the Seleucid royal court. Erasistratus was born on an Aegean island, possibly Kos, but exactly which one of three islands with very similar names got mixed up in different sources over time. According to Pliny the Elder, he was a grandson of Aristotle, though the Byzantine Suda disputes that and suggests that Erasistratus came from a family of Cnidian physicians instead. Either way, he did train at the Asclepion on Cnidos, and may have studied at the Platonic Academy in Athens before finding his way back to the East. At some point in the early 3rd century, Erasistratus joined the royal court of Seleucus I Nicator as the king's personal physician, and Erasistratus was credited with diagnosing the future Antiochus Soter's depression when the prince fell in love with his own equally aged mother-in-law. It was supposedly Erasistratus himself who encouraged Seleucus to divorce Stratonike and allow her to marry his son instead. Ultimately, though, that is not the work that Erasistratus went down in history for. Eventually, probably once the construction of the city had largely completed, the physician moved to Alexandria near Egypt and accepted Ptolemaic patronage. His reasoning is obvious enough. Ptolemy I lifted the prohibition on human vivisection for his physicians, and the leading empiricists of the day all flocked to Egypt. It helped that local traditions of mummification had built up an unusual amount of anatomical knowledge in the Egyptian medical community to begin with. That is why they were the best healers in the region before the Greeks started moving in. Erasistratus, in particular, worked well into his old age, dissecting corpses alongside another famed ancient physician, Hierophilus. Supposedly, the dynamic dissecting duo also did live dissections of prisoners sent to them personally by Ptolemy. Gruesome though it may have been, there is unfortunately little substitute for the real thing. And they learned valuable information about what healthy living organs looked like, and what various ailments did to a living body. It is deeply horrifying and unethical, but, for example, only by dissecting a living, or actively dying, body could they learn that arteries contained blood at all times, just like the adjoining veins. That seems painfully obvious in hindsight, but how often were people going to see an artery cut open with the surrounding blood vessels completely intact on a living person outside of that context? Less gruesomely, but only slightly so, Erasistratus and Herophilus were also responsible for the first detailed Western study of the anatomy of a human brain and the cardiovascular system. Prior to their work, it was believed that arteries led back to the heart while veins led back to the liver. They conclusively proved that this was all one heart-centric system. Likewise, their work was also the first to widely disseminate proof that the nervous system led back to the brain, thus highlighting the role of the brain in making the body function. They even began identifying which nerves affected motion and which affected the senses to return to their experiments on living subjects. Erasistratus in particular was credited with definitively proving that when a person drinks liquids, the fluid goes to the stomach rather than the lungs, a point of genuine controversy at the time. He also, speaking of fluids, invented the first Western catheter. And speaking of lungs, he sort of guessed at their purpose, but not knowing molecular science, made some amusing leaps in logic. In Erasistratian medicine, the lungs sucked air in through the mouth and nose and passed it to the heart, where it became a substance called pneuma that was pumped into the blood as it circulated. So it's not technically correct, but it is not nearly as wrong as many of his contemporaries. Of course, his work wasn't flawless. Erasistratus was a diehard believer in the theory of plethora, a common idea among Hellenistic doctors that the vast majority of problems were caused by undigested food building up in parts of the body. Ironically, this might have been reinforced by the discovery of arterial plaque in his dissections. However, the plethora theory actually did cause him to shift away from purgative treatments like bloodletting and rely more on a healthy diet, exercise, and regular bathing in his prescriptions, which again gave the impression that his ideas were working, even if it wasn't for the reasons that he thought. Although Erasistratus ultimately moved to Alexandria, many physicians followed in his footsteps at the Seleucid court and the Asclepia patronized by the Seleucids. And his work joined Hippocrates as some of the most influential in the Mediterranean world until the time of Galen. So there's our episode on Seleucid intellectualism. It was something. It's just very annoying to be working with a hypothetically Greek-dominant culture and still not get any of the benefits of Greek literary tradition in my sources. Regardless, next time we will get ready to return to the narrative with an ever-important Meet the Neighbors speed round. Until then, if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.